Good morning, everybody. Welcome. We're delighted to have you here. My name is John Hamry. I'm the president at CSIS. And before we do, before we start events, when we have outside guests like you, I always start with a little safety announcement. Michael Matera is going to be responsible for your safety. And so if we hear a voice that'll say, follow his lead, he's going to take you right through that door. There's the stairs right there that take us down to the alley. We'll take two left-hand turns and a right-hand turn. We'll go over to National Geographic. They know we're coming. And there's a great show right now, and I'll pay for the tickets. Okay, so nothing's going to happen, but if it does, please do follow Michael's instructions. Okay. Thank you all for coming today. I was talking with Julio as we were kind of getting ready back in a room, and I said, you know, there are an awful lot of Americans that talk about courage, but I said, I can't say how awed I am to see you and the courage that you've embodied for Venezuela. And I mean that very sincerely. This is a, I can't think of a more traumatic time and a more traumatic set of events that gets far too little focus and attention in America. Imagine if something, if there was a disaster in America that all of a sudden 90% of the people in a state were living below the poverty line. Would we tolerate that? Would that not be the first story every night in the news? When the average Venezuelan has now lost 24 pounds because of starvation? That, why is that not the lead story every night in America? And these are our brothers and sisters. They're so close to us. You know, to have a country of first world sophistication slip backwards in decay is just breathtaking. And we're not outraged in this country the way we should be. This is crucial, and not enough Americans know about it. And so we're so grateful that that the opposition leader, I don't know how to call him, a hero, Julio Borges, is here to share with us his perspective on what's going on in Venezuela. I mean, right now the only story in Washington today is about North Korea. Well, this story is just as important. It needs to have just the same focus, and I'm so grateful that you, Julio, I'm grateful you're here for us. Because we need to bring this bright spotlight in Washington sharply on what's the tragedy that's unfolding in Venezuela. So I want to say thank you for coming. To get started, Michael, I'm going to turn to you. You're going to offer some preliminary remarks. You know, he's going to get it started for real. I just had to get it off my chest that I'm so glad that all of you are here to focus on this with us. Michael, why don't you come up and get this program going for real? Julio, thank you for being here.
Now, Dr. Hamry, thank you very much for those words. It's important that you are with us this morning to open this event, which is really one of the most important events that we've done on Venezuela over these last 2 years. Our Venezuela project is one of the top priorities of the Americas program here at CSIS. Together with Moises Rendon, who's been with me from the beginning, from day one, he was the first person I hired, we've really tried to shine the light on Venezuela in lots of different ways. And we've done this with the help of a lot of different people, Gustavo Tarre, Herbert Torres, Mark Schneider, who's sitting up here today. Mark Fairstein, and Mark Schneider, who's back with us in the audience. We've had an incredible team working the Venezuela issue. The day after was the initial focus of our work over the first year. The day after seems to be further away. We're hoping that it's going to be closer with the passing of the weeks and months. Our focus over these last few months has been more on the humanitarian situation in Venezuela, and we have a number of initiatives there. I'm not going to waste more time talking about our Venezuela program. I want to turn the floor over to the three gentlemen sitting in front of you. But before doing that, I'd like to turn to Landon Loomis. Landon is the Senior Advisor on Western Hemisphere Affairs and International Economics for Vice President Pence. The Vice President and President Trump have been very, very actively engaged on the issue of Venezuela, and that engagement has clearly made a difference. We very much wanted to have Landon with us today to share a few words before we turn the floor over to the panel. Landon?
Thank you, Michael. Thank you to CSIS for inviting me to participate and for organizing this event. What I'd like to do also is recognize Julio Borges as well, the Vice President. Really enjoyed meeting you, Julio, in Lima again, speaking with you and your colleagues. He came away from that encounter really impressed by your story, by your eloquence and your ability to speak to a broad global public about the situation of Venezuela. And I think that, as Dr. Hamry said, there is an importance, it's an important moment now that we share our sense of outrage. And I can assure everyone that the Vice President and the President do share that sense of outrage. But being able to connect with and highlight the experiences of leaders like Julio is very important, and we appreciate the role that CSIS is playing today to do that. Venezuela is a top priority for this administration. When Vice President Pence traveled throughout Latin America last year in August, he talked about a sense of urgency. The problems in Venezuela have been on a slow motion crisis, essentially, for a long time. And what this administration has done has said, this will not stand. There's a sense of urgency in our policy and our engagement with Venezuela that is important and is consistent, and that the Vice President articulated when we traveled through the region last August. What's happened since then is that a sense of urgency has become a sense of frustration. Frustration because despite a historic, unique, global sense that what's happening in Venezuela is unacceptable, despite the consensus that's built up around the region, we still have in Venezuela a political situation that is devastating to its people. And that sense of frustration is where we were on May the 19th. I think that, as my colleague Juan Cruz said this morning, the Maduro administration missed an opportunity on the 20th by holding that election, by not listening to the overwhelming voice of the international community asking the regime to postpone the elections, to commit to a free and fair, credible electoral process, to make decisions based on the good and well-being of the Venezuelan people. The Maduro administration missed an opportunity when they held those elections. So as expected, on May 20th, a dictator stole a rigged election. He won. That was a foregone conclusion. He got to set all of the rules of the game in advance and ensure that at every turn the deck was stacked in his favor. But it is interesting to note that he got half as many votes as he publicly declared that he expected. He set a record for abstention, more than doubling the abstention rates from the last presidential election. And that's in a country that Julio can attest to has a proud heritage of civic participation and engagement. So clearly there's discontent, but the cynical use of food as a weapon in the electoral process has been a decisive factor, and it will continue to be while the Venezuelan population is enduring such misery. The United States, since for years, has maintained a steady drumbeat of pressure, a campaign to bring the full weight of economic and diplomatic pressure to bear to bring about the peaceful transformation of democracy and restoration of democracy in Venezuela. We will continue to do that. Our response after the May 20th election was swift. On Friday before the election, we designated Diosdado Cabello and his family as for being corrupt officials that are aiding and abetting the corruption that is undermining the well-being of the Venezuelan country and its people. On Monday, we issued an executive order that further tightened the financial sanctions, which we have already put in place, to ensure that the corrupt regime does not have access to the U.S. financial system. Since the beginning, we have sanctioned more than 70 Venezuelan-related individuals under four different executive orders. And it's important to remind all of us, to highlight an aspect of the sanctions policy which isn't always addressed, which is, what is the purpose of the sanctions policy? Why does the United States use sanctions? It's to change behavior. That is to say, the sanctions themselves are a function of the decisions and the choices that the Maduro regime is making today. If those choices change, if behavior changes, sanctions are designed to be removed. And that's an important concept as we think about the way forward. Ultimately, the way forward, the solution, lies with the Venezuelan people. The ultimate arbiters of Venezuelan democracy are the Venezuelan people themselves. And this is an important moment for the Venezuelan people to think about how to participate and support and be a part of the process of building international pressure, which has reached a new level. The U.S. and the world will stand with the Venezuelan people. We have the OAS General Assembly happening just next week, where we plan to continue our efforts to work collaboratively with countries across the region and across the world to call for free, fair, credible elections, for the release of political prisoners, to address the humanitarian crisis, and to restore and respect the constitutionally mandated democratic institutions like the National Assembly. This project has the full attention of the leadership here in the United States. We're working across the interagency to build a coalition of partners across the world who share this commitment, who want to work to restore democracy to Venezuela. Thank you.
Thank you, Landon. Thank you, Michael. Thank you all for being here. I'm just going to briefly introduce Julio to get the panel started. Julio Borges is a lawyer and politician. He founded Venezuela's largest opposition party, Primero Justicia, and served as national coordinator since the beginning of the party in 2000. Mr. Borges is currently serving his third term as congressman representative for the state of Miranda, which is part of the capital, Caracas, and in Venezuela's National Assembly. He also served as president of the National Assembly from 2017 to 2018, January 2017 to 18. Julio Borges was an opposition leader during the negotiations between the representative of the Maduro regime and the opposition parties that took place in the Dominican Republic. He has become one of the main opposition leaders in Venezuela and abroad, advocating for the restoration of the country's democracy and calling out the human rights violations that are systematically taking place in Venezuela. Mr. Borges studied law at one of the best universities, not saying that because I also went to that same school, Andres Bello Catholic University in Caracas. He also got a master in philosophy in Boston College and a master in public policy at Oxford University. With that brief introduction, Mr. Borges, I want to thank you again for coming to CSAS. We're delighted to have you here, and now the floor is yours. Thank you. Sure. Okay.
Well, thank you for this introduction, Moises. I appreciate it. Thank you, Michael, Landon, and my friend Mark. Well, I would like to have two part expositions. In the first part, I would like to underline some issues that I think are very important in order to understand how Venezuela regime is a threat for the security of the region and democracy all over the world. And secondly, I would like to share with you our view about the future and the role that opposition have to play in order to speed the change in Venezuela. Well, first of all, I think that what is going on in Venezuela is a connection, a real connection, between Cuba, Nicaragua, and Venezuela. Venezuela has played the role to mainly to finance all the movement, the extreme movement all over Latin America. In the recent past, there was a lot of money due to the oil revenue, but now it has in a different situation right now. But even though we have such a hard crisis in Venezuela, Venezuelan government is still paying the bills from countries like Cuba. 2 weeks ago, we have the news that Venezuelan government used $400 million in order to buy oil for Cuba. In this very moment in which we are facing this huge crisis, Venezuela and Maduro prefers to get the money and to provide money to Cuba and not to use it in a different issue. That's very clear how a real solution in Venezuela could lead to a real solution also in Cuba and Nicaragua as well. For me, it's very clear that even the social and political manifestation that we are seeing in Nicaragua are the result that Venezuela has not money in order to provide funds to Nicaragua. And all the social unrest that Nicaragua is facing is due to the weak capacity of Venezuelan government in order to provide money for Nicaragua and Cuba as well. There is a third actor, which is Russia. Russia probably has not the strength in order to maintain Venezuela as it did with Cuba in the past. But for me, it's very clear that Russia wants to play a role in order to use Venezuela to take part in the region and to destabilize the region through the conflict to Venezuela, and has some importance business in oil or in gas, as we have seen in the recent agreements of Venezuela. Then, from the point of view of Venezuelan government right now, I guess that their main expectation is to wait in order to see a change in the region. If you see Telesur, I hope you don't, but if you see Telesur, you will see permanently that all the hope of Venezuela and Telesur is about change in Mexico, change in Colombia, and change in Brazil. This is a very dangerous situation because, in my opinion, there is a very real hope in Venezuela's government in waiting for a change in the region in order to break all the alliance that exists surrounding Venezuela democracy. And this is a real danger that we are facing this very year. And for them, it's crucial to obtain a new landscape in Latin America in order to break the consensus that exists around the problem of Venezuelan democracy and human rights. At the same time, there is after the so-called election of the May the 20th, we can expect an increase in the number of people going out of Venezuela, immigration. And this is a real threat for the region as well. Right now, almost 3 or 4 million Venezuelan people have left the country, and this number will grow. And this is a very difficult situation for the peoples around Venezuela. And we expect that this number, due to the political and social crisis, will increase and will produce also a destabilization in the region. Another concern that we have, and I would like to underline, is that as far as the oil revenue decrease, the opportunity to open on legal activities such as narco-traffic or organized crime is growing in Venezuela. A month ago, I have an opportunity to have a very interesting meeting with a German official, and he told me that the problem of drug traffic is not only related to subversive groups in Latin America, such as guerrilla movement in Colombia and Venezuela. But also the drug traffic has to do with the pass from Latin America to Africa and then to Europe. And the German government has detected that also the money from the drug traffic goes to Islamic groups, that they gain money through the drug traffic through the region. So we are talking here, and this is increasing in Venezuela, about a global negative business that has to do with the guerrilla movement in Latin America, destabilization movement in Latin America, but also have to do with Islamic and radical movement in Africa and also in Europe. So there is a common threat that has to do with the open use of the drug business in Venezuela right now. Another issue that we have to expect about Venezuelan near future is the use of conflict as a defense mechanism for Maduro. It's very clear that as far as he is involved in more troubles, internal troubles, he will look for troubles abroad in order to keep power in Venezuela. That is the case, for example, in Honduras. That is the case, for example, the internal campaign in Mexico or in Colombia. It's very clear that there is a corruption business related to Maduro's government with the food buy, the famous clubs. He buys the food from Mexico, he buys the food from some parts of Chile and Colombia, and he used some structures that after they made the business with the people in Mexico, Colombia, or Chile, they help radical groups in Mexico, Colombia, or Chile. That is the case of López Obrador in Mexico, and this is the case of Gustavo Petro in Colombia as well, and this is the case of different movement in Latin America. So the use not only of drugs, but also corruption, in order to fund radical movement in the region, it will be an increased practice of Maduro, because he would like to have different problems from Venezuela and use conflict all over Latin America as a mechanism for defense of his own situation as well. Honduras is another case that I would like to underline. Another issue that I would like to underline. What is Maduro's philosophy before all the crises that he has created? I guess that his only vision will be to resist. That will be his only position in front of all the crises he has and he's facing already. As you know, we have hyperinflation, we have the drop of all revenue and production, we have external suits against the oil industry, we have a huge military internal crisis, we have the humanitarian crisis, we have the internal and external pressure, and Maduro's answer for those crises will be only resistance. Not change, but resistance. He would like to be like a new Cuba, but in the continent. Jorge Rodriguez was 2 days ago with the European ambassadors in Caracas, and he has a unique petition for them. He told them that he would like to be treated as Cuba. They don't want to be sanctions, they don't want to be a different treatment, but the petition of Maduro's government for Europe was, we would like to be treated as Raúl Castro and Cuba. And this is very interesting because they consider themselves as a new Cuba. But what Maduro's don't have idea is that economic change in Cuba could produce political change in Cuba. Different from Venezuela. In Venezuela, only the political change could produce economic change and freedom. It's the other way around. But what they have right now in their heads, in their minds, is only to resist. They don't want to change the system, they don't want to change the economy, they just want to consolidate a Cuban system in order to be in power. Then, regarding opposition, I would like to be very clear that in these recent years, we have done almost everything. We went to the parliamentary elections in 2015, we won, and the government shut down the parliament. Then we used our mechanism in the constitution to call for a recall referendum. The government stopped the recall referendum. Then we went to the street and had 130 days of demonstration. Unfortunately, with the an equal number of people who died for the violence from the government. Then we went to the regional elections. The government made a fraud. Then we went to a dialogue. I was the chief of the organization from the opposition in dialogue, and the government closed the door in our face. So we have done everything: elections, dialogue, demonstrations, a constitutional mechanism. So we have done everything. Right now we are in a situation in which we did a real damage to the government on May the 20th. The government never expected to have so low amount of votes on the election. And it's very, very important to underline that Venezuela's people's dignity is so high that even though in order to have something to eat, you have to be on your knees before the government, even though that people express by their dignity with the silence of not participating in the election. And I'm very proud that Venezuelan people show that amount of dignity before Venezuelan government. Maduro was surprised about the outcome of May the 20th. Right now, more than 60 countries deny that election. The G7, the G20, the European Union, the Group of Lima, the United States. Right now, we have all the alliance with democracies all over the world. But we need to strengthen our internal pressure in order to match the external pressure and the internal pressure and make an outcome this very year, a democratic outcome this very year. For me, it's very important to transmit to you, to emphasize that, and Landon is very clear about it, and Vice President Pence as well, that we are in a real timing, in the real opportunity for change in Venezuela. Maduro has created so many crises, difference in the economic issues, in the social issues, in the military issues, in the internal issues, that in my opinion, he won't be able to deal with all the crises. People always ask, why is Maduro in power? What happens that this guy is in power after all the destruction of Venezuela? Well, in order to understand this in historical terms, in Venezuela there is a mixture of ingredients which are different from other country. We have oil, we have army force, and we have the Cuban regime behind. The combination of these three elements, army force, oil, and the Cuban regime, produced that the change in Venezuela, which is happening in a slow motion. It's like a small motion movie. But it's happening, and it will have a great outcome, and I guess the year has to be this year. In order to take for the final part and have a conversation with you, what about the opposition? We have our main challenge. Our main challenge is unity, but not only political unity, because the struggle in Venezuela is not opposition versus the government. We are building a Frente Amplio, which means the whole society against the regime, the church, the university, the entrepreneurs, the unions, the NGOs, and the political parties. The Frente Amplio wants to be the expression of a plural and democratic society that is against a totalitarian regime. We have our first victory on May the 20th. But we have a second challenge, which is to produce a different approach to the army force. We should say to the army force that they are part of the future, that they are part of democracy, that they are part of the development, that we are not looking to the army force for revenge. On the contrary, that we have to build together a new and a unique country with freedom and institutions. Our third challenge as opposition is to express to the world that we have a plan, that we know how to deal with crisis, that we know how to change economy, that we know how to change institutions in order to have a democratic society, that we want an open society, an open Venezuela, in order to make a huge cultural and economic and social exchange with the world, that we know how to deal with the crisis. And fourth, that change, our fourth challenge, that change is unavoidable, that change is gonna happen, that we are not doomed as Cubans in order to live decades waiting for change, that Maduro is weak and we are strong. That democracies all over the world, and this is a demonstration of that, is with Venezuelan people and with their dignity and with their rights. That change will happen very soon in Venezuela. And the fifth challenge that we have, and this is something that you also have helped us, is to show to the rest of the world the depth of the humanitarian crisis in Venezuela. That this is something that has to shake consciousness all over the world. What is happening in Venezuela, in my opinion, has no comparison with any crisis right now in the world. And I guess that within this long tradition, as Michael says about Venezuela and the United States, I'm sure that there is a real compassion about what's going on in Venezuela. I have had three meetings with Vice President Pence, and I can feel that he has a personal commitment with Venezuela. And when I heard your opinions and your voice about what's going on in Venezuela, I can feel that it's not only a political term, it's not only a political problem, it's a human crisis. It's a human crisis that touch your heart, that touch your soul, that touch the history between Venezuela and America. And I'm very grateful about your devotion about what's going on in Venezuela. And it will be something to be very proud in the future when we reach change in Venezuela to tell to our sons and our grandsons and all our descendants the role that played America, the role that played Latin America, the role that played United States in fighting for freedom and dignity in my country. So I'm very grateful for that. I'm very grateful for that opportunity. And most of the challenge that we are accomplished as a position is in order also to collaborate with the threat that right now Maduro's regime represents for not only the region, not only for the United States, but also for democracy all over the world. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Borges. Can I call you Julio now? Now we're going to have about 20 to 25 minutes of conversation between Mark and Julio before we open it up to Q&A. I'm sure many of you have questions, so be patient. We're going to get there. But before that, Mark Fursten, a friend and colleague, has served in senior positions in the U.S. government and the private non-government sectors. In the Obama administration, he served as the White House as a special assistant to the president and senior director for Western Hemisphere Affairs. In that capacity, he helped implement the president's normalization policy toward Cuba and orchestrate the president's trips to Cuba and Argentina, oversaw the development of the president's Peace Colombia initiative, and coordinated the increase in U.S. assistance to Central America and advance and deepen the U.S. cooperation between Mexico and Canada. Very full background on the whole region, Mark. He currently consults with Major League Baseball on Latin American issues and serves as a senior advisor to the Albright Stonebridge Group, among other groups. Thank you, Mark, for being with us. You hear Julio's remarks. We are all curious to get your thoughts and your reactions before we sure. We get in a conversation. Yeah.
Okay, well first, thank you very much for the invitation. It's an honor to join Julio, an honor to join you, Moises. It's obviously a challenging task to follow Julio. I don't think there's anyone who's more eloquent and better informed about what's happening in Venezuela and what's happening outside Venezuela to place additional pressure on the Maduro regime than Julio. I've known Julio for many years. We met 15 years ago, I think. I was at the time a consultant for RCTV, which was the radio and TV network that was shut down by Hugo Chavez. Dr. Hamre spoke earlier about how courageous Julio is, and I've, in my 30 plus years of working around the region and around the world, I've met many people who've been fighting for democracy and rights in their country. And I've never met anyone as courageous, committed, as principled as Julio. He's done it, obviously, a great personal sacrifice. He has a beautiful family. And I'm confident that when the history of this period is written, and the final chapter will be a good one, I agree that change is unavoidable, as you said, Julio will really go down as one of the heroes in this period. You know, Michael spoke earlier about the CSIS effort on Venezuela and the enormous amount of time we are dedicating to that, and Moises has done a phenomenal job leading that effort. And I know it's a very, very painful and frustrating to work on this issue, and I felt that myself. And in the last 2 years, I was in the White House the last 2 years of the Obama administration, and I spent probably more time on Venezuela. I did spend more time on Venezuela on a sustained basis than any other issue. And I think the same is true with my successor as well. And it's frankly dispiriting or frustrating, as Landon said, that you know the regime has held on this long. I mean, and despite the highest inflation rate in the world, despite the deepest economic contraction in the world, despite what's probably the highest murder rate in the world, despite a fairly significant set of U.S. sanctions and sanctions by other countries, and the domestic pressure as well that Julio outlined. You know, in terms of the international effort, Landon spoke very well to this. Of course, the United States has taken the lead in sanctioning 70 individuals. It is a target-rich environment. This regime is full of senior officials who have been engaged in corruption and human rights abuses, crimes against humanity, drug trafficking, et cetera. And Juan Cruz, my successor this morning, noted that with regard to the sanctioning of Diosdado Cabello, it's one of several in the hopper. So there are plenty more to go. And of course, we've seen sanctions by Canada, by the EU, from Panama, and from Switzerland as well. And Landon, you know, laid out this strategy, which I think is very sound, which is basically to try to change behavior within the Maduro regime. And as Juan Cruz said this morning, the idea is to both punish and to change behavior. And I think the idea is to try to create fissures within the regime to signal that there is a cost to officials to continuing to align themselves with this regime, but also to provide incentives for them to distance themselves and to negotiate and to provide a way out as well. And you know, not only is it important to send a signal to those who are being sanctioned, but the idea is to send a signal to those who have not been sanctioned yet, that they could be next, and if they take certain steps in advance, they can avoid getting on that list. Now, we've seen some defections within the regime, but to be honest, we have not seen as much as we would have hoped, and perhaps Julio can provide some insight to that. You know, my understanding is that, you know, that the obviously there are broader sanctions beyond the individual that the United States can impose, and they have the Trump administration has imposed some broader economic sanctions. You know, there's hesitation, I think, to go too far, and there's been a lot of discussion, I know, about the possibility of an oil embargo, for example. And Juan noted this morning that there's a whole series of steps that can be done, you know, well in advance of that. There's a series of intermediate steps that can be taken. But I think there is concern about inflicting greater pain on the Venezuelan people. I think there's also a sense that the greater economic sanctions might be unnecessary because the economy is collapsing on its own, or collapsing because of the misrule of the Maduro, mismanagement of the Maduro regime. We've seen oil production just collapse, and that collapse is accelerating. And there are potential costs to the United States as well with regard to certain measures, especially with regard to an oil embargo, which could potentially have impact on gasoline prices in the United States. I think there are more steps that other countries in the United States can take. OAS General Assembly is coming up. I think it would be wonderful if Venezuela were suspended from the OAS. I think it would be a... It's an appropriate move, and I think would send a very, very powerful signal. Venezuelan government pretends they don't care about that. They do a lot. We saw what happened when they were suspended from Mercosur, and Delcy Rodriguez literally trying to break into the meeting. And Venezuelan government puts an enormous amount of effort to try to prevent their diplomatic isolation. There's only one thing preventing the Venezuela from being suspended from the OAS now, and that's the Caribbean bloc, frankly. And I served in the U.S. mission to the OAS about 20-some-odd years ago and during the Clinton years. And at the time, the Caribbean bloc was a set of 13 countries that felt that were always there providing their votes when it came to issues of democracy and human rights. And they have effectively been bought off now. Venezuela is providing oil subsidies, and I believe that Caribbean countries have abandoned their principles. I know there's a great effort now to try to encourage more Caribbean countries to break and to provide the votes to finally be able to suspend Venezuela from the organization. The OAS, my understanding is that next week the OAS is going to publish a report with regard to crimes against humanity that have been committed in Venezuela. And that report will be referred to the ICC, which can then conduct investigations of individual Venezuelan officials who are responsible for those crimes against humanity. I think it would be helpful if other countries were to match what Panama did. It's impressive. Panama is really the only Latin American country that's really taken strong action vis-a-vis Venezuela. There's been some wonderful statements, Lima Group, and that's great. But I think that there are other steps that countries can take, and one would hope that they would either match Panama or take the appropriate steps given their own relationships and economic relationships and financial relationships with the Venezuelan regime. I think, though, that despite all those efforts, it's not clear that international pressure will be sufficient to change behavior and to promote a democratic transition in Venezuela. And I think especially if you consider that there are countervailing factors as well. There's Russia and China, which continues to provide support to the regime. And Julia referenced Russia in particular. But I think what we've seen in the last 3 years is there's been at times domestic pressure and been at times strong international pressure, but they often haven't been in sync. So a couple years ago, and Julio outlined this, the efforts of the opposition, there were a lot of protests, demonstrations, participation in elections, but frankly at the time the international pressure was very weak. And I think the opposition in particular was undercut at the time of the recall referendum, when the recall referendum was canceled by the Maduro regime, and the Vatican then jumped in and then oversaw the talks or negotiations, which ultimately failed because there was no international pressure at the time. Now we're seeing sufficient international pressure, but frankly there's limited domestic pressure.
Yep.
And I think the tragedy there, among the many tragedies there, is that the Venezuelan people have been demobilized. And this is not a criticism, it is an observation. People spend their days looking for food, looking for medicine, many are going into exile, many are planning their exit. They are afraid because the regime has used violence against protesters before. They're afraid to go to jail and be tortured, and that's all understandable. And I think we've reached a point now where many people in Venezuela are waiting for desperate measures. They're waiting for a military coup. They're waiting for military invasion, which is not going to happen. And I think that contributes, unfortunately, to the demobilization as well, because I just don't think, I think this is critical, because the Maduro regime needs to feel greater domestic pressure than they currently feel. And I guess I would end by then maybe posing a question to Julio. Does he agree with what I'm saying? And feel free to take issue with everything I've said, particularly the final part. But you spoke to this as well, about the importance of creating greater internal pressure to match the external.
Yeah.
And I guess the question is, what sort of steps can you take to do that? Is there anything that the international community can do to help you create that greater international pressure?
Yeah. Well, actually, I agree with what you say, Mark. And as Mark said, Mark is someone who knows Venezuela very well as a professional and as a public servant. And we are very thankful for all the job in Venezuela. This is part of the timing tragedy that we live. When we have enough internal and domestic pressure, there was the beginning of the international pressure, and there is no match in both. Right now, the situation in Venezuela, many people who come from Venezuela here knows that the possibility to at least organize or to call for demonstrations, for example, right now is very limited. And all social and political activists live under real fear, and more than fear, panic. because the government has no limits to do whatever they want. But I guess that the only window of opportunity has to do with the social issues regarding hyperinflation and food and medicines. Although people, regular people, no activists, regular people live under fear, I guess that the situation could be so dramatic in the future, more dramatic than it is right now, which is a tragedy, but it can be more dramatic, that people could put fear in a side and go to demonstrate their real feeling. It's very, very curious, but if we see the people's behavior on May the 20th in the so-called election, it was a very clever and sharp way to protest without violence, because people took the decision, as I said, as I mentioned, although they depend on the government for food, although that submissions, people took the decision no to present and no to go to vote. And I'm very sure that in a limited situation, people can overcome fear and make demonstrations because it's within our DNA. It's almost as in Nicaragua. No one expected Nicaragua's demonstration and riots. No one's, and it happens. And as I mentioned, it has to do, and it's related to Venezuela. So answering your question, Mark, I think that we should expect the internal pressure coming from the social and economic reality more than the political effect, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. And politicals play a role to play in this situation is to make easier the organization to people to demonstrate for their rights.
Thank you, Julio.
Thank you, Mark.
On the same line, I know this is a very important issue, and I think I agree with you, both domestic and international pressures are needed to see any change in Venezuela. We all knew what's going to happen the day after the elections. Nicolas Maduro was reelected, but I haven't really seen yet some sort of plan moving forward. So could you describe for us, Julio, what kind of route do the Venezuelan people have in order to engage on this fight for restoring democracy in Venezuela? What kind of plan moving forward can they engage in order to mobilize that domestic pressure that is needed?
Well, it's a crucial question, Moises. And what we have to start to think is that we are in a factual situation. Factual situation. It's a situation in you have to fight strength versus strength. It's only there is no legal, constitutional, institutional battlefield. It's just strength, and that's where Maduro led Venezuela to the law of the jungle as we are living right now in Venezuela. So in that situation, we as a position have, besides the challenge that I mentioned about unity, about the message to the army force, about the plan for the future, about the humanitarian crisis, we have to keep the idea of elections as the final goal for building a solution in Venezuela. And this is not an idealistic or romantic or naive position. On the contrary, we are aware that we are facing a very tough situation in Venezuela, a factual situation, as I mentioned. But in any of the scenarios of Venezuela, if we have to undergo a coup d'etat, or if we have to undergo a social explosion, or if we have to go for a new and real negotiation, no Zapatero's one, a real one, the final goal has to be elections in Venezuela. And we have to be very clear about that. Because one thing is change of the actual and current establishment, And the other thing is, what is the final goal that we are looking and building for, which is the free expression of Venezuelan people. And for people in Venezuela and abroad, it seems some awkward that we are talking about election, but it has a real argument. We don't have election on May the 20th. We say not to these so-called elections, and we would like to have real elections in Venezuela. And this is a role that have to play democratic leaders in Venezuela and democratic leaders that support Venezuela, to support real elections in Venezuela. But not in a naive way, but under the real consciousness and being very aware that we are facing a dictatorship in Venezuela, and that's the reason we are looking for real elections in Venezuela, with all the implements that I mentioned early before about unity, about our solutions for the crisis, about our message for the army force, about the humanitarian crisis, about our approach to the international community, about the unavoidable feeling of change in Venezuela, but with the final goal, elections and freedom for the people, no matter what could cause this change in Venezuela. It will be a social explosion, it will be a military reaction, it will be a real negotiation, we don't know. We are pushing for change with a final goal that is a democratic election in Venezuela.
Thank you, Julio. There was a turning point after May 20th. There was something that happened that we have never seen before. I mean, the international community recognized President Maduro as the president of Venezuela until May 20th so far. I mean, they condemned the Constituent National Assembly and not recognizing them. They condemned all their institutions. But Maduro, we had that recognition as the president. Now there is a debate going on what type of legitimacy has Maduro moving forward. Is he the president of Venezuela or no longer is the president of Venezuela? There is also government in the exile, quote unquote, government operating. There is a Supreme Court operating in Bogota, in the parliament of Bogota, of Colombia. There is different institutions trying to operate from abroad. So can we get your thoughts? How do you see this issue moving forward in terms of legitimacy of the current regime in Venezuela and other institutions who are increasingly gaining importance in the international community?
Well, that's the reason, Moises, I said that we are living a factual situation. Maduro is not a legitimate president, but is there. But it doesn't have to do with his authority or his democratic outcome. No, it's just a factual thing. It's a dictatorship that is using and kidnapping power. And Venezuelan people has done, as I mentioned, everything in order to produce a change in Venezuela. I think that a crucial actor in change has to do with the army force. And one of my main concerns is that after May the 20th, the principal enemy of Maduro and Cuba is the Venezuelan army force. This is in which stage that we are living after May the 20th. I'm sure that Maduro and Cubans right now are thinking how to destroy army force in Venezuela. And this is something that has to call the attention to democracies all over the world, because this is the last institution that we have in order to restore democracy in Venezuela. And they are right now producing a huge repression on the army force, and this repression is led by Cuban officials, and it's very clear that after May the 20th, that would be the new trophy that Maduro wants to show to the Cubans, the destruction of the army force in Venezuela. Anything different from that right now, a government in the exile or institutions in the exile, they can help in order to call the attention. But in the urgency that we are living right now in Venezuela, this problem about the almost destruction of the army force have to be one of the most important issues that we have, we should have to put on the political and public opinion agenda.
Mark, yeah.
If I could just ask about that, obviously there's a lot of discussion about the army as a potential democratic savior, if you will. And when I look at the Venezuelan armed forces, I guess what I see is a force that has been indoctrinated and purged over the years, indoctrinated in socialist thinking and anti-American thinking, a force that's been trained and armed by the Chinese, the Russians, the Cubans, in sort of different ways, a force that has engaged in human rights abuses, crimes against humanity, and engaged in other criminal activity, drug trafficking, for example. So I look at them and they seem to just be an unlikely democratic savior, if you will. But sort of where am I wrong? Obviously no force is monolithic, and that, I assume that's part of the answer, but you can sort of just speak to that a little bit.
About the armed force?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, if you see right now, in the last 2 or 3 weeks, there are more than 200 young officials in jail. And for the government, this was a real surprise because they thought that these young officials were the new generation of Chavista's army force. And the great surprise was that these people don't like what is going on in Venezuela, don't like the Cuban influence within the army force, don't like Maduro's undemocratic behavior. And it's very, very important that the new elite of young people from the army force have a reaction for democratic and constitutional behavior in Venezuela. And for me, it provides me a lot of hope that there is a moral reservoir within this destruction that we are living in Venezuela, and mainly among young people in the army force. Mm-hmm. And we are not talking about 2 or 3 guys that are talking bad about the government. We are talking about more than 200 officials. So we are not in front of a small conspiration. In my opinion, we are before a huge rebellion within the army force, which is totally different. Mm-hmm. It's the whole institution, the whole body, that is telling we don't want to be Cuba. And we have to take attention, to pay attention to that situation, which is happening right now.
Thank you, Julio. A very brief question before we turn to the audience. Mm-hmm. Sanctions. The U.S. main policy towards Venezuela has been a sanction policy. Have sanctions been effective on your point of view, and what else can be done to increase its effectiveness and towards the behavior of change that Landon was describing for us?
Yeah. Well, as I told you, I was the chief of the opposition representation in Dominican Republic with the dialogue during 4 months. And if sanctions were not working, the government haven't talked about sanctions 9 of 10 words that they said in trying to negotiate. It was amazing. In every single second was sanctions. We have to move sanctions. We don't want more sanctions. You are blamed to be sanctioned, everything. So sanctions are working. And it is important element, not only for punishment, but for division within the regime. And it's amazing when there is a rumor that new sanctions are coming from Europe or from the United States. These big guys that you see screaming in the TV about revolution, they try to say to everyone they know, do you know if I am in the new list of the sanctions? So they're full of fear. They're full of fear about sanctions. They are working, and these are a very strong element in order to break the system or to lead to a real negotiation. I have no doubt about the deficiency of sanction in this very moment. And as Mark said, the government is auto-sanctioning themselves. All the problem of hyperinflation, the problem of the drop of oil revenue, the problem of the international issues as ConocoPhillips, it has to be blamed on Maduro's regime. It has nothing to do with sanctions. So we have to be very clear. The government wants to blame sanctions about everything that is happening in Venezuela, but I have so many research, not from Mark, but as good as Mark's research, that said that people don't buy the argument that Venezuelan crisis is due to the sanctions. Not at all. People is very clear that the economic and social disaster, it has to do only with Maduro. Maduro tried to sell during the last 6 years that all the mess that we are living in Venezuela has to do with what he called the economic war, la guerra económica. And they repeat it right now, currently. And in the surveys, people who believe that the economic war was the origin about the social crisis, it was not more than 13%. So one of the things that we have to be very hopeful about the change in Venezuela is, and this is very important, is that there is a real mental change in Venezuelan people. I remember one of the surveys that Mark did in Venezuela about estatization, nationalizations, London. And it was amazing. At that time, 90% of Venezuelans support estatization. They were very happy. We like more entrepreneur from the private sector to the state. Right now, the support for estatization is 3%. 3%, from 90% to 3%. What is important of this fact is people has changed. People has once entrepreneur, people was investment, people was trade, people was democracy. They don't buy the Cuban project anymore. So this is a very important issue that shows that Venezuelan people is really ready for change and right now.
You all being very patient. Please, before you ask a question, identify yourself, say your name and affiliation, and just keep the question short, please. Yes, Danny.
Hi, how are you? I'm Danny Bahar from the Brookings Institution. I want to push back a little bit on the question Moises asked, because he asked about the strategy. And you talked about the day after. You said, well, the day after, there's going to be an election, and I think we all agree on that. But I think there's a little bit of a vacuum, at least seen from outside, on what are the steps until the day after. And you mentioned two things, so I want to divide the question in two, because I'm an economist, so I will ask more than questions that I promised. One is, like you're saying, there is a slow motion change happening. And I wonder what's the evidence on that? Is there something there that you know that maybe we don't know? I don't know if you can say it, I guess not, but I would love to know what's the evidence on the fact that there's a slow change happening, because some other people claim that the government is actually, in terms of social control, they're very strong. Mm-hmm. So if there is a slow change happening, so maybe you don't need a strategy, but if there's no evidence of it, what is the strategy? I mean, you said you try dialogue, you tried elections. What is the strategy that will unify the opposition? Because I believe that unifying for the sake of unifying is not enough. You need to unify around a strategy, and that's, I think, the big, what it looks from outside, that there's a vacuum on that. Having said all this, it's not a judgment. I know the opposition is in a very, very tough position. But I think, given that we are in this setting, it's worth hearing your thoughts. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, well, that's all.
Yes, let's do that one first. And Mark, feel free to comment too, if you okay. After Julio.
No, well, listen. I think that there are a lot of evidence about change in Venezuela, a lot of. And let me say the question around. I don't see no example of no evidence of change. You know, if you see what is going on in the economy with the hyperinflation, what is going on with the oil production, what is going on within the army force, what is going on in the international realm, all these factors, if you accumulate it and you zoom out, then it's the force of change that is happening in Venezuela. And 2 months ago, it was impossible to talk about a military crisis. And now it's an open issue in Venezuela. It was impossible to think about young people in the military has a rebellion. And now there is a real issue. And the government's answer is only repression. And for the government, change have to do with the impossibility to maintain Petrocaribe, for example, and the impossibility to have all the financial help to Cuba, for example. An evidence for change is people on May the 20th telling clearly to Maduro, I don't recognize your elections. Change is that a year ago, as Marthek, I remember I was in Europe a year ago talking about sanctions, and I remember President Tajani telling me it won't happen. Europe is not prepared for sanctions to Venezuela, and it had happened. And a year ago, it was impossible to think about it in the United States, and had happened more than 70 officials. So if you see in a very objective way, there has been a lot of change in the last month regarding Venezuela. But the question is the same. Why is Maduro in power if there is that amount of pressure on Maduro? Well, I repeat it. I think that the combination of what is on oil today with what they have of army force and 2 spoons of Cuba, and you shake it, that's what preserve Maduro in power, which is very fragile, but is, in my opinion, the real support that they have right now. If you take that, there is nothing else that supports Maduro within or abroad Venezuela.
Mark.
Yeah, so at the risk of offering advice to a politician, foreign politician about his own country, which I do with great hesitation, but I do think that part of the opposition's approach does need to be about unity and reconciliation. The Maduro base is very small. The Chavista base is not. And I think there's a difference there. And Hugo Chavez, whether you liked him or not, the truth is he was at times very, very popular with extraordinarily high approval ratings. Now, part of that had to do with high oil prices and whatnot, but there was a certain identification that people had with him. And years ago when we were doing focus groups, and I recall hearing Venezuelans talk about Hugo Chavez, and even people who were not Chavistas, who were not identified with the government, would say, for the first time in our lives, we have a president who cares about the poor. And we can agree or disagree about that, but that was the perception that people had of Hugo Chavez. Now, I think that Chavez's legacy has been damaged considerably by Maduro, and they've sort of seen the consequences of so much of what Chavez has tried to do. But that said, Venezuela is a very, although the opposition has overwhelming support now and Maduro has very little, it is still a severely polarized society in many ways. We think the United States is polarized. It's nothing compared to Venezuela. I think any new government will have to take that into consideration, both in terms of rhetoric and in terms of programming and policies and reaching out.
Any other question? Yes, Gustavo.
One cortina, yeah.
And there's one there. Let's take two this time.
Yeah, there was a big discussion in Venezuela about why Maduro called last Sunday election. And there were several goals. One of them was to gain a bit of legitimacy. You already answered about that. The second one was to discard the mood opposition and to replace by a more accommodating opposition. The third one was to change inside the Chavismo, and it has to something to do with what Marx was saying. Maduro founded Somos Venezuela, a new party. Mm. And a great part of the publicity in the campaign was not for the PSUV, but for Somos Venezuela. Mm-hmm. And the fourth goal may have been to initiate a new dialogue with a new opposition. And this dialogue was not about human rights or election, but about the economy, about social situation, and about sanctions. In what kind, in your view, both of you, were these goals achieved by the election on last Sunday?
Yes, let's take one, two on the back.
Hi, I'm Juan Cortines. Julio, I have a quick question. I wonder if you can share with us your thoughts about the role that José Luis Rodríguez Zapatero is playing now in Venezuela. The day of the election, he was there supporting the election. He recently met with Pope Papa Francisco, and it seems he's up to something, and I wonder what you think he's up to.
Thank you.
Well, I would like to answer the question of Zapatero with Gustavo's remarks.
The easy one first.
No, it has a connection, a real connection. Listen, on Sunday, May 20, the date of the election, Zapatero was very sad. Zapatero was very sad, and he was in a meeting with some journalists from Spain and Europe, and some ambassadors. And he was angry and mad because he was really clumsy. I don't know if the word corresponds, but it was very inappropriate, because he said that all the purpose of Chavismo fails on May 20. His chief aim was to produce this new dialogue with a new opposition. And it was very important that Falcón denies and rejects the result. And even it's important for you to know that Maduro called 2 times to Falcón that night, and Falcón rejected to take the telephone to talk to Maduro. And it was very important because beyond the election, the purpose to build this fictional dialogue with Zapatero again, thanks God, it was dismantled. And his internal numbers with the new political party of Maduro was a complete failure as well. So in my view, as you mentioned, Gustavo, there is no one even issue for Maduro to celebrate on May the 20th, not even one. And even he won the so-called elections, it was a Pyrrhic triumph. And in my opinion, May the 20th put Maduro in a countdown. If we keep the pressure, if we keep the plan, if we are willing and capable of building that we are not an opposition but an alternative for democratic force in Venezuela, I really believe that Maduro is living at countdown. And the role that Zapatero plays is very, very sad. It's amazing to understand how this guy, who was president of Spain 8 years, is doing this kind of role as an advocate of this regime. There is no explanation for that. The official response of the Spanish government was very strong against Zapatero. Public opinion in Spain is killing him. And people in Venezuela, yo no sé cómo se dice en inglés, lo corrió de los centros, ¿cómo se dice eso?
The stock, yeah, they kicked him out.
Keep him out from the electoral centers. So, and he wants to try again and again to be part of a new dialogue with the government. It's something that we have to reject, and we ask to our friends and allies of democracy in Venezuela to reject the role that Zapatero is playing, because it's very harmful for democracy, not only in Venezuela, but also in the region as well.
Mark, any thoughts?
Just briefly, I think it's a reminder that there have been a range of international actors in Venezuela that have not been helpful. And it goes beyond just the, you know, the few countries that we often name. And Julio just spoke to about one individual. You know, we saw earlier with UNASUR playing, I think, a very unhelpful role. I think that is fading now as other countries are taking more of a lead. So I think it's where I think the dynamic is better. And Zapatero used to be at the center of activity, and now he's very much isolated, which I think is a positive thing.
Yeah. Any other questions? Yeah. One here and then one over there.
Thank you. Diego Sharifker, just arrived from Venezuela 2 months ago. I have two quick questions, one for Mark, maybe, would be, of your experience in the U.S. government, there's a sort of catch-22 of support of humanitarian assistance towards Venezuela in the sense that I know firsthand the real impact of the crisis in Venezuela, but stabilizing the crisis or the social crisis in Venezuela could have the counter effect of stabilizing Maduro in government. Do you feel that could be in any way, and how to play with those two situations? And also to Julio, what does that mean politically? If you solve the humanitarian crisis in Venezuela, does that favor the government, or does that show that the government failed in trying to govern Venezuela?
Yes, thank you. Let's do one more over there on the left side.
Hello. Good afternoon. My name is Neo from Embassy of Malaysia. If I may give a little perspective and my observation, because I was posted in Venezuela for the past 3 years, and I just arrived DC a couple of months ago. I totally understand the situation in Venezuela, because I lived there for the past 3 years, the most difficult time. I went through your protests last year. I went through the hunger. I went through the shortages of medicine and everything. What I want to ask and what I want to highlight is the issue, the political crisis and the constitutional crisis or humanitarian crisis in Venezuela. Most often than not, people forget. For me, you need to understand first the social element in Venezuela. Like what you pointed out, Venezuela is a very unique country. Unlike many countries, I mean, you need to understand from their perspective, first of all. You have spoken about the measures to restore democracy in Venezuela through external force, through dialogue, through protest, you know. But it seems like it did not work for the past many years since Chavez era. You started the protest in 2003, 2002, and many, many rounds. Yeah, 2013, right. 2017. But it seems it did not work so far. And also you're talking about dialogue. It depends on how sincere both sides want to come into the negotiation table. And if you're talking about external force, you're talking about the sanctions by US, sanctions by EU, sanctions by Mercosur or OAS. It did not work because first you have to understand Venezuela. I think the element is many people fail to understand the element and the thinking of Venezuelans. You coming from Venezuela, I'm very sure. The problem for me, what I see is the gap, extreme gap, the political gap between far left and far right. You do not have a moderate stand to bring back the people. I can talk about this because coming from Malaysia, I think we all witnessed what just happened in our general elections, you know, without any use of force or anything. We changed the government, the 62-year-old government we just recently changed, you know. And you're talking about corruption, you're talking about, you know, things like this, which you highlighted earlier. But for me, I think you need to look at the people first, what people want and how you educate the people in order to make change. So that's what I
thank you.
Motivation. Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah. Okay.
I'll answer the first question. The United States does not use food as a weapon. The Maduro regime uses food as a weapon. And I'm not privy to discussions that Landon and Juan Cruz and others may have internally, but I'm confident that they are making every effort possible to get food assistance into Venezuela as quickly as possible and as massively as possible, and making no other calculation about that. And the reason that food is not getting in is because the Venezuelan government is blocking it. I mean, USAID has a warehouse in Miami. That food could arrive in Venezuela, and food and medicine and other supplies can arrive in hours. And if Maduro, and it's important for Venezuelan people to understand this, if their own government, you know, decides right now that they will accept humanitarian assistance, that food will be down there today, tomorrow. And there's only one thing blocking that from happening. And I think it's, you know, obviously the United States has been providing financial assistance to Colombia and to the UN network to provide as much humanitarian assistance in neighboring countries, but really the key is to get it in there. And some is getting in, but not nearly enough.
Well, I would say about what Diego mentioned is that what is a tragedy for us, for public opinion abroad Venezuela, for Maduro is the best thing that has happened to him. He really likes people leaving Venezuela. He really enjoys people going out. Venezuela, oil is declining. Ramon could tell us. But right now they're trying to live with remesas, you know?
Remittances.
¿Cómo se llama?
Remittances.
Remittances. We did on October last year a survey, and at that time there was 17% of the population received some help from a friend or a family abroad. So there is a growing amount of money that we are subsidizing Maduro's regime. People is working here in Washington or in Colombia or in Brazil for Maduro. It's a tragedy. And that's the reason what is a drama for us, which is the humanitarian crisis. For Maduro, it's a solution. And we have to take that on our account, because he's happy that people is leaving Venezuela, because it's people who has freedom, who has capacity to work, and to maintain the regime from abroad to with the remittances.
Remittances.
Remittances, yeah. And this is a real tragedy, that we are, this is in the new step, when there is no more oil in the same amount as the past, this money is perfect for him. That's the reason he took the control of Banesco, because he's the main source of this kind of operation from millions of Venezuelans in different countries to their families within Venezuela.
Yeah, which, by the way, remittance has become, as Julio is saying, a very important income for the country. I mean, oil has been always the main income of Venezuela, but remittances will soon, if the tendency continues, will soon surpass the oil revenues. So that's a very important factor to keep in mind. If there is something clear, Julio, in Washington, is that Venezuelans are not alone. We're all watching closely what's going on the ground. We're all trying to help, and we will continue to do so. We want to thank you to be here in CSA with us. Thank you so much. And keep fighting for democracy, but we all need it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you.
My dear friend.